This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Amanda Petrusich. I'm a staff writer for the magazine, where I write mostly about music.
And I'm David Remnick. I've asked Amanda to join me today because we're going to be talking about music during the pandemic and at this strange and unique moment in history.
Music is one of the only things that has kept me feeling sane and grounded recently. At the same time, the pandemic has been devastating for musicians, like so many other workers. Concerts of all kinds were canceled, and that affects everything from your local bar bands to giant festivals like South by Southwest.
So what we're going to do today, we're going to have live performances from two artists who released records this year. John Legend is the winner of about, I don't know, a dozen Grammy Awards, one of them for the song Glory that he wrote for the film Selma. And then Amanda is going to talk with Phoebe Bridgers, who's become a real star of the indie music world.
Being in quarantine has been, for me, a really great time to listen obsessively, carefully, slowly to music. David, have you found any new music that's been sticking with you?
Does the new Bob Dylan album count as new music? I think there's a four-hour song on there that I've listened to 25 times. But other than that, no kidding. I've been listening to a lot of old soul music, which seems to kind of, I don't know, lift me up out of the slough of despond.
I understand that. That music's perfect for that. And I, too, have been really deep into that Dylan record. I mean, it feels like it arrived at kind of the precise right moment.
Good day to be living and a good day to die. Being led to the slaughter like a sacrificial lamb. You say, wait a minute, boys. You know who I am.
Are you hearing any music that's been recorded since the pandemic hit, or is it too early for that?
Well, I think those records are starting to appear. In May, the British singer Charlie XCX released a new record called How I'm Feeling Now, which she recorded entirely in quarantine at her home studio in Los Angeles. And, you know, she makes what sometimes gets called hyperpop or futuristic pop, this very kind of synth-driven, really propulsive, kind of glitchy production. But I think it's one of her best records. I found it to be a little more idiosyncratic, I think a little more experimental, and also a little more intimate. So for me, those were really welcome things. And if quarantine ends up yielding more records like that, I'd be really pleased.
Amanda, for years we've been hearing about how all the money, all the economics of music is in touring. Album sales are way down. Streaming makes money, but really for the very top artists. So without the revenue stream from live shows, what's happening out there for musicians?
I mean, I think musicians like all of us are really very much trying to figure this out day by day, hour by hour. I think we're starting to hear about artists booking whole tours through empty venues and then live streaming those performances. I used to really like going to shows in part because it meant I finally wouldn't have to be staring at my phone for a few hours. But I do think we're seeing a lot of, you know, ingenuity, a lot of inventiveness, a lot of persistence in the face of tragedy. You know, we're seeing artists using YouTube and Instagram Live to broadcast their shows, to stay in contact with their fans without hitting the road.
You know, one of the people who's been doing that is John Legend. He's been hosting Zoom concerts and he's released an album over the summer. So I spoke to John right about when that album came out. at the very unpop star hour of 7 in the morning.
It's not musician's hours, but it's father of toddler hours, so it's fine.
I'm very grateful to be talking to you, John. You know, Amanda, you talked about releasing an album right now, but Legend told me that he was still recording the album when he went into quarantine.
Usually one of the last things we do is, one, we add featured guests, and two, we usually do some string recordings. The guy who normally arranges our strings, a guy named Matt Jones, he brought the players in to kind of individually play their parts and do it while distancing, and then stack it all up together, and finally you've got a recording.
Is there anything lost in the making of an album when you're not in the same room together? It's been a long time since bands and musical collectives and of all kinds gathered in one studio, played the track, and separated things out. Mm-hmm. Even somebody as old school as the late Leonard Cohen, I remember interviewing him at his place in L.A. Uh-huh. He had one little microphone on his desk like I do, a guitar behind him, and then he would send the tracks to his producer and some other musicians, yeah, and it would come back. And he was somebody in his 80s. Yeah. Is anything lost by not being in the same room?
I think there is something lost in certain instances. For our rhythm sections, we are in the same room. When we're recording the rhythm section backing tracks, I like to be there to talk to the drummer and tell them what I want. I like to be there with the horn players and the backing vocalists. So there are a lot of instances when I won't just let somebody send me something. It's not as free-flowing and collaborative if you don't interact with each other.
Now, in the publishing business, a lot of people are putting off releases of books. In the movie business, things have stalled. Mm-hmm. And in the music business as well, a lot of albums have been delayed, thinking that releasing things right into the teeth of the pandemic, mm-hmm, might not be such a good idea. Why did you choose to put out Bigger Love right now?
I've never held an album back, and I have a hard time even conceiving of holding an album back because I spend so much time working on it. It takes up so much of my energy, and then I'm so excited about being done with it that I'm like, why would I hold this back from the public? Like, it's time for them to hear it. And I feel like of any of the albums I've put out, I feel like this is the album that feels like it should come out during this time because it feels like a kind of a musical hug. It feels like a music that would help one get through tough times. And I feel like this album was made for this moment.
I think one of the songs that fits into exactly what you're saying thematically and in the way it made me feel when I was listening to it for the first time last night is a beautiful song called Never Break that you're going to perform for us now.
Yeah, we got a good thing, babe. Whenever life is hard, we'll never lose our way. We both know who we are. Who knows about tomorrow? We don't know what's in the stars. I just know I'll always follow the light in your heart. I'm not worried about us, and I've never been. We know how the story ends. We will never break. We will never break. Build on our foundation, strong enough to stay. We will never break. As the water rises and the mountains shake, our love will remain. We will never, no, never. We will never, no, never. It's more than a good sensation. It's more than a passing flame. You are the explanation of what love really means. It's bigger than you and me. It's 1 + 1 = 3. When we talk about forever, then forever's what we mean. It's
So I'm not worried about us, and I've never been. No matter what may come our way, we will never break. We will never break. Build on our foundation, stronger than the pain. We will never break. As the water rises and the mountains shake, our love will remain. We will never, no, never. We will never, no, no, never. We will never, no, no, never. We will never break. Build on our foundation, strong enough to stay. We will never break. As the water rises and the mountains shake, our love will remain. We will never, no. No, no, never. We will never. No, never. We will never. No, we will never. No, never. We will. No.
So there's a stoicism about this song that seems fitting to the moment. It hasn't been just a pandemic. It's amazing to say the phrase, just a pandemic. But we're also living through a moment in American history when it comes to race, when it comes to police violence. Tell me about recent days. What, if anything, has changed for you?
Well, what has made me hopeful is seeing large multiracial coalitions of people on the streets, not just an outrage about George Floyd, but an outrage about a system that devalues Black life. And I think the COVID crisis and the ongoing crisis we've had with policing have a common theme in that Black folks tend to bear the brunt of these crises more than other people do.
What was your experience as a young man with police, if any?
I didn't have a lot of experience with the police personally, but I had many friends and family members who were arrested, many friends and family members who went to jail and prison in our community. I didn't have an experience with the police until I went to college.
You went to the University of Pennsylvania?
Yes, absolutely. University of Pennsylvania, West Philadelphia, and what you'll notice when you're a Black student at a college, you're often treated like you don't belong there. I was pulled out of my car, not pulled physically, but asked to get out of my car and prove that I owned that car for no reason. We've been having some burglaries in the area, so we wanted to check your ID. And I was recently talking to my young cousin who's at Penn right now, or just graduated actually this May, and she experienced the same thing. She was in a lab building where someone thought she didn't belong there and called the campus police on her. And we've seen this happen in college campuses all around the country. We see it happen in parks and all kinds of places where Black people are treated like they're imposters. Too many young Black people experience that every day.
You gave a commencement address at Berklee College of Music. Mm-hmm. And you said, history has shown us that we are most capable of making dramatic changes to repair our country after crises, from the Great Depression to the most recent financial crisis. Our art is critical in defining how we choose to rebuild the world. How does art have any effect on the political and social life of the country?
Well,
you've made political music, God knows, whether it was with the Roots and many other things. What do you hope for that music to do?
Well, a lot of my music is there to inspire people, to uplift them, to make them think about the ones that they love and connect with the people they love, and to give people a common sense of humanity. And then art in general, I think, is there to help us imagine a different future.
What music did that for you as a young guy?
Oh, well, Stevie Wonder was a huge influence to me, showing that someone who had so much success as a musician could be a voice of conscience and could not only write songs, but lead movements like, you know, the one to make Martin Luther King Day a holiday, or other things he spoke out against, like apartheid in South Africa and various other things. He showed me that this was part of what an artist could do in the world. Marvin Gaye showed me that. Other artists showed me that.
Are you compelled to write any new music now, considering what's going on?
I probably will again soon. I usually take a little break after I've finished an album because it's such an intense process. And I also don't like to write at home, so that's a challenge.
You have one of the most, the transparency of your home life is kind of amazing. I mean, we seem to feel that we know you through, and your wife and your kids through social media and much else. I watched one of your online performances, and your daughter and your wife both ended up stopping by and hanging out.
Well, I've long since adjusted to social media, and I think my wife in particular, she's been very open about sharing what's happening at our house. And I think between the two of us, we enjoy sharing pieces of our life. We still keep a lot private, believe it or not.
John Legend, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I talked to John Legend in June. His new album, Bigger Love, is out now.
Just ahead, I'm going to talk with the great songwriter and musician Phoebe Bridgers, and she'll perform something for us. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Oh, you did that perfect.
I'm coming for your job, David.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Okay, so here is a first turntable. This is a really excellent turntable because it plays 78s as well as 45s and 33s. There's also like a cassette player in the corner here. This cabin is like 1,200 square feet. There's really the three turntables is a bit much, I think.
In the spring, our music critic Amanda Petrusich went into quarantine just a couple of hours away from New York City. She's isolated from other people, but also from most of her vast record collection. She could only carry one or two boxes of records with her. And for somebody who cares as much about music as Amanda does, those are pretty hard choices.
And here are some records. Okay. Donnie and Joe Emerson, this record is wild. John Coltrane, more John Coltrane, more John Coltrane. Leonard Cohen, for when it's late at night and you've had too much wine. Merle Haggard's Greatest Hits, for when it's 3 in the afternoon and you've had too much wine. Neil Young, Johnny Cash.
So I feel like if you were to ask any music fan, you know, like right now, pick the 5 things you take with you, you know, to the other side, and you don't know when you're coming back again. I think it would incite a kind of panicked meltdown in most of them. It's hard to anticipate, you know, what you're going to want and need and when. So you kind of start taking this weird inventory of yourself and the contents of your mind and sort of what you need to get by.
I have a compilation called New York City Blues. I have some Lightning Hopkins, Folk Songs of Puerto Rico. That's another Folkways record. Music of the Bahamas. That's another Folkways record. Traditional Cajun Fiddle, a great Folkways record. Some Mississippi John Hurt.
So I've been listening to a lot of releases put out on a label called Folkways, which was founded in New York City in 1948 by Mo Ash and Marion Disler. And they were interested in capturing and preserving folk culture, kind of in the broadest and most expansive sense of the phrase. And they released some pretty esoteric stuff, poetry, spoken word, instructional records, a lot of field recordings of people. I would say I own probably about 36 Folkways releases, and they're the kinds of albums that I buy whenever I see one, regardless of whether I've heard anything on it before, regardless of whether I recognize the artist. You put it on the turntable, and it's truly anything could come out of your speakers.
Okay, I'm going to put on Folk Songs of the Catskills.
All you pretty fair maids of courage brave and true, I'll tell you how bird a happy lives and what all troubles do. I'll tell you how bird a happy lives and plainly understand you must never try to fall in love with a good-looking man. When I was
so one album I've been listening to a lot well up here is called Folk Songs of the Catskills. They were sung by a woman named Barbara Moncure, and her singing partner is a guy named Harry Siemson, who specialized in animal husbandry and was the official historian for the town of Kingston, which is very close to where I am.
So every day I looked about for a good-looking man. Well, my wish, it seems, it came too soon on a Sunday afternoon. As onwards home from church, I trip.
When I spend time in a new place, I think I like to get to know it by getting to know its vernacular music. That's a really useful way in for me. It's a way of getting closer to the spirit of the place. I will say I am presently covered in poison ivy, so I still have a lot to learn about the Catskills, but this has been a kind of a useful way to start that education.
My gents stepped out, and so did I, to take a pleasure's roam. My gents stepped out, and so
did I. Tuareg music of the Southern Sahara, which is one of those records I picked up without really knowing very much about it or what it would sound like or what it would contain or who had made it. And I've just found it wildly transporting. There's a lot of ambient noise. At one point, a baby starts crying. You can hear animals. They're scrappy. I mean, it's the sort of sound of people in a room or people in a field or people on a porch making music together, making music in the kind of precise place and way where it was intended to happen. I don't know, something about the world slowing down, and I think the size of things shrinking, this sort of matches it. It's a time of closeness with your community and the people who are immediately around you. So this feels like the right way to kind of celebrate that or to lean into that. I've also been listening a lot to a compilation of recordings by Joseph Spence, the Bahamian guitarist. It's called The Complete Folkways Recordings from 1958. And when Joseph Spence made most of these recordings, he was in his late 40s. He'd worked most of his life as a stonemason on the Bahamian island of Andros. And he was recorded by a folklorist named Samuel Charters and his wife, Anne. And when they first encountered Spence, they described him as sitting on top of a pile of bricks and entertaining some workers who were nearby hammering the frame of a house together. So nice. I miss the experience of live music so deeply and so profoundly that it is, yeah, anything that can kind of approximate that in whatever way I can on record to, you know, to get as close to that feeling as I can in a safe way is just so welcome. For me, I've been really doubling down on the records that make me feel, you know, like I'm part of a kind of vast and weird continuum of humanity. They remind me in this really visceral way that no anguish is really new, and humanity has overcome a lot of monstrous things before. I like remembering that there is a past and there is a future.
That's music critic Amanda Petrusich. Amanda, devoted readers of your work in The New Yorker might not know you as a folk music aficionado. You're generally covering new artists, people coming right down the pike. And one of the artists you've been paying a lot of attention to this year is Phoebe Bridgers. You profiled her when she was releasing her second solo album called Punisher. Tell me a little bit about her. Who is she, and why is her work so interesting to you?
Phoebe Bridgers is a singer and songwriter from Los Angeles. And her work is really intimate and intense, but also sort of dark and funny. And I wanted to profile her because I think her records really speak to what it's like to be young right now, when the future seems like such a murky, almost impossible idea. Phoebe Bridgers struggles a lot in her work with this question of, how do you think about starting your life when every time you turn on the news, someone else is telling you that there's no tomorrow?
And you spoke with her in the summer at a really intense moment in the midst of the massive protests for racial justice around the country.
It's really good to see you, dude.
It's so good to see you. I know. I've missed the world, but it's nice to see you.
Yeah, likewise. I know we obviously met for the first time in New York City in late February, just shortly before the coronavirus pandemic really took hold in the U.S. And then the last time we talked, you were driving around L.A. with me on FaceTime, the first time I've ever reported a magazine profile that way. And I remember thinking that we were living through such a dramatic, kind of world-changing, once-in-a-lifetime moment. But now, somehow, we are living through another one of those moments.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I just wanted to check in with you. Kind of, how have you been metabolizing recent events?
I've been metabolizing them with joy, I guess. Like, just white people being silenced on social media also, I think, is the best thing that has ever happened. Like, truly. it was, like, amazing to watch people struggle with that. But also great to watch people kind of adapt. I love the weird corner it's put capitalism in.
Right. Yeah. And in the midst of all this, you're releasing an album.
Yeah.
which I want to talk to you about. So part of being the subject of a New Yorker profile is knowing that the writer of the profile is going to call everyone you know and say, hey, tell me about Phoebe. And so one of the people I spoke to when I was working on my piece about you was Matt Berninger, the frontman of the indie rock band The National. And he gave me this quote that I thought was sort of incredible, where he said, Phoebe writes so well about boredom and sadness. And I'm curious if you feel like that seems like a pretty true description of your work to you.
Yeah, I think so. I think I never really try to tackle giant things. I just kind of go into writing with whatever information I have in that actual moment. And a lot of the time when I'm writing something, I am bored and sad. I will use any excuse to not write. So writing is like, I have this weird guilt about how I didn't do it earlier, and I'm just kind of daring myself to write about whatever comes to mind. So I think I just kind of naturally write about boredom and sadness that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I feel like this quarantine for me, I've tried really hard to have a kind of routine, because otherwise I think it is, you're sort of plagued by guilt nonstop.
Right.
Well, this feels like the perfect moment for you to perform Kyoto. And so this song deals with, you and I talked about this a bit, some, you know, pretty painful feelings of alienation and a failed reconciliation, in this case with your dad. Can you tell me a little about what was going on for you when you wrote it?
Kyoto is about, it's a little tongue-in-cheek about my own strong opinions weakly held, you know, like just feeling super hateful and resentful, and then knowing that it just dissipates with like one conversation. My inability to like predict that too. I think on the first record, there's some resentment that's just kind of like full throttle and not held back at all. And I think maybe I'm becoming a little more self-aware that it's all a little more complicated than just saying how I feel about it. If I say how I feel about it in the moment, it's just ridiculous. Like the I'm gonna kill you line is not true, luckily.
Yeah, it's a great line though.
check.
That's the only vocal warm-up that works for me, by the way. All right. I will mute you and play it.
Day off in Kyoto, I got bored at the temple, looked around at the 7-Eleven. The band took the speed train, went to the arcade. I wanted to go, but I didn't. He called me from a payphone, they still got payphones. It cost $1 a minute to tell me you're getting sober, and you wrote me a letter, but I don't have to read it. I'm gonna kill you if you don't beat me to it. Dreaming through Tokyo skies, I wanted to see. See the world through your eyes, and then it
Yay.
That was amazing. Are you getting used to playing for no audience, sort of performing for a screen?
Kind of. It's hard to get used to. I hope I never get used to it, but.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're directing a lot of energy out and probably less is coming back in. It's got to be a kind of a weird flip-flopping of the normal performance experience.
Totally. Yeah. It's very weird. Yeah. The main thing is like not forgetting words. I feel like I didn't realize how much of a tool I used other people for like remembering my own songs. So
you meet people in the crowd, like mouthing them back to you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. So I know you started playing guitar as a teenager. We talked a little bit about, you know, the guitar being a kind of rebellion against your very sweet mom who wanted you to play the piano. But I'm curious about when you started writing your own songs.
I think I wrote my first song when I was like 11, and it was called The Only Bird Flying the Other Way, which I was not. I was a private school white girl, and I thought I was so different and that nobody understood me, which is wild. So yeah, humiliating.
Aw, The Only Bird Flying the Other Way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very funny, but also kind of sweet. It's kind of tender.
Yeah.
So if there were not a pandemic going on right now, what would your life look like?
I think I'd be on tour still. Maybe I'd be in Europe. I've on purpose not looked at my canceled dates. It's like a couple weeks back, someone was like, where would you be playing? And I was like, Madison Square Garden. Like, it's just painful.
I shouldn't laugh. It's so painful. Of course. I mean, besides performing, what's your favorite part of being out on the road?
Just being, it's like summer camp, being surrounded by my friends and feeling just, you're never as famous as you are like five blocks from the venue you're about to play. So that's fun too. Just like living in a weird simulation where I'm the most famous person is funny. Like going to a coffee shop and everyone's like, oh, we're going to the show. And then five people at a table over are like, we're going to the show. And I'm like, ha ha ha. I don't ever feel like that in my real life. So
I really can't thank you enough for doing this, Phoebe. I feel like we are quarantine bros for life.
Yes, seriously.
After these past few months.
Seriously.
And it has really been a pleasure speaking with you again.
Thanks, dude. Okay.
Close my eyes and fantasize. Three clicks and I'm home. When I get back, I'll lay around. Then I'll get up and lay back down. Romanticize a quiet life. There's no place like my room. But you had to go. Like a wave that crashed and melted on the shore. Not even the burnouts are out here anymore. And you had to go. I know, I know, I know. Out in the park we watched the sunset, talking on rusty swing set. After a while you went quiet and I got mean. I'm always pushing you away from me, but you come back with gravity. And when I call you come home, a bird in your teeth. So I gotta go. I know, sirens sound, you'll hide under the floor. But I'm not gonna go down with my hometown in a tornado.
That's Phoebe Bridgers back at her home in Los Angeles in the summer, playing I Know the End. Amanda Petrusich profiled her for the magazine, and you can find that piece at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more in a minute.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Amanda Petrusich, a music critic for the New Yorker.
And I'm David Remnick. We've been talking about listening to music, especially the role of music, during times of turmoil and real stress. Music keeps me alive. It really does. Whether it's the mellow tone of Lester Young's saxophone and Billie Holiday singing to it, or the Chronic, these things are essential to life. I don't know what I'd do without it. It's like imagining life without food or drink.
I agree completely. It's a lifeline, and I'm grateful for it. And on that note, let's close the program today with an essay by Donald Antrim. It was published around the shutdown, and it speaks to the question of what music can do at a time like this when we're not seeing family and friends. We're not getting out the way we used to. Antrim's piece is called Music Will Be Important. We've adapted it for radio, and here it is read by Russell G. Jones.
We're all spending some time alone now. I once spent the better part of a year by myself in my apartment. It was 2016. I was not in quarantine. I was sick with what we and our doctors call major depression. I would rather call it suicide, which I see not as an event or a deed, but as the natural ongoing outcome of trauma and isolation. And though at times I functioned, I nonetheless could not bring myself to write or read much or cook for myself or exercise, or open the mailbox. I let the mail sit until the mailman, unable to fit all the flyers and bills and tax notices emptied the box, wrapped everything with a rubber band, and left the bundle on my entryway floor. The problem was terror. Problem was that I was not safe. I'd lost my sense of belonging and lived in abjection, lonely, cut off, trying not to die, but working just to stay alive. Maybe at some time in your life, you've hidden yourself away, scurried past the mailbox, let the phone ring, if it rings at all. Maybe you've distanced yourself from friends or lost them for good. What will happen to you if you go outside? And we like to say that we're wired, as if we're computers or electrical grids. You know, my wiring is shot. She needs recharging. He's in shutdown mode. Another thing we like to say is that music soothes the savage beast. The expression is a misquote from the playwright William Congreve, who in fact writes of the savage breast, not beast. Music has charms to soothe the savage breast, to soften rocks or bend a knotted oak. A savage breast is what we feel when we are alone too long. The year I was alone, I sat on the sofa and listened to the music that had mattered to me when I was young. Steppenwolf and Pink Floyd and Black Sabbath. Sitting in my apartment in Brooklyn that year when I couldn't easily leave the house, I listened. I was always shaking and hyperventilating. I felt my body pressed down as if by some weight that I could not see. It was a feeling of being crushed from every side. Maybe you've felt this. Sometimes I got up from the sofa and paced, but then I might stop to adjust the speakers. I put my gear on platforms made to dampen vibration, and I added big fat speaker cables. And as I fiddled with the system, it came to sound, to feel more and more close. I put on the music that I came to later in life, jazz and electronic and experimental music and Bartok and Mozart and Bach. My shoulders dropped. The muscles in my neck and face relaxed, and I breathed more deeply. I prayed, and I wept. I stood at the window and I watched the people on the sidewalk below, the parents with children, groups of friends, neighbors bringing home groceries. I thought of all of us who, like me at that time, lived in danger and in fear. A fear that might seem inexplicable, yet also concrete and real. Dear God, take care of my brothers and sisters. Take care of our families. Take care of the people in hospitals and on the streets. I put on records and prayed. I was, we could say, sitting in music. I wasn't wired. I was wire. The sound waves were wire, and the air in the room was wire, and the walls were wire, and the books in their shelves were wire, and my body was wire. I found my communion with others who were alone. And I might notice when I felt you near me that I was tapping my foot and my thoughts were, for the moment, clear, and that I could smile a bit.
That was Russell G. Jones performing Music Will Be Important by Donald Antrim, which was published in The New Yorker. My co-host today was music critic Amanda Petrusich. Amanda, thank you so much.
Oh my God, my pleasure.
Amanda is the author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, a book about hunting for rare records. And you can read her all the time at newyorker.com. Thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Meng Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour.